No, it's meant to. So when people rise up because of their natural will to freedom, they come up with some sort of bullshit law that makes it look like we're getting more rights, but we're just getting fucked in the ass again. I mean, it's, I guess I'm a little bit cynical in that regard, but that is my take on it.
Yeah, you said it.
You said fucked in the ass too, so I think that's like I don't know. That's
This is
like
what happens, Larry.
I didn't see that one coming. But no, it's like I do think that people are like so victimized in so many ways that yeah, we turn on each other. That going back to cultural cannibalization, it's just like it's a yeah, I don't know. It's a shame, I guess is the only way of saying it. But also, it helps me look upon other people with, and myself with more sympathy too. I think that's like also in getting into all this shit, I hope it just like would make you a more compassionate person to the human condition and like how easy it is to be fucking jerked around and like pushed around and misled. And I've felt that way for most of my life.
It's humiliating and offensive to try and
Yeah.
tell somebody that the wars that they fought and that they're like people that so many people could die for the profit of so few who aren't even they're not putting anything on the line in any true sense, and they're just reaping benefits from so much bloodshed for so long. It's inconceivable for people, but it's character armor that stands between them and that recognition,
Well,
because it's humiliating. I mean, it's offensive. How
of
dare
course,
you
yeah.
suggest that we've all died for the profits of a few? I died for the, my people have died for the freedom of
Right.
that we have.
Yeah,
Well,
it's such a
con is
sensitive.
so long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead,
It's
Kate.
such a long con that a lot of us forgot about it, you
There's
know?
no more basis for comparison. That's how the con works. You don't have a basis for comparison, so there's no way to recognize it. It's become so massive and so overwhelming that it's like it's inconceivable, you know? But you know, there's strides and things have taken place. I mean, now I know it's. I think this is a big thing, and I recognize and I hear it get said that it's like, I forget what the percentage is at this point, or I don't know what it is, but I guess it's like 70% of Americans don't buy the official story of JFK, at least, you know, and that's like the most obvious display of bullshit, you know. I mean, it's so overt, you know.
But
But it takes time, you know.
that's just it though, man. So like I tell you, this was like such a fascination I had growing up. There's a reason that the JFK thing sort of sticks with me is because I grew up and I remember my mother and her boyfriend of many years, you know, sort of like my parental figures. And you know, you see something on TV, some comedian makes a joke about JFK or something, you know, and you're like, hey, so what is that all about? And it's like, you know, the fact that these people who are not particularly conspiratorial people in any stretch of the imagination, you know, these are pretty run-of-the-mill American, you know, born in the 50s, go along to get along sort of, you know, people in the control system. And they would be like, oh yeah, you know, sure, you know, JFK, yeah, it's total, you know, totally conspiracy. And I'd be like, well, wait a second. So you mean like everybody knows this? And they're like, yeah, everybody knows. And I'm thinking like, so, but how come nothing, no one did anything about it? And that was like, as a child, that was the most mind-blowing thing that you mean to tell me that 300 million Americans, or whatever it was at the time, let's say it was even 150 million Americans, you know, I don't know what the population difference was. But to say the fucking country knew that there was a conspiracy to kill their president by some other people within the government, you told me no one fucking did anything about it? Like,
Right.
it wasn't like we had a riot over, you know, We can riot over fucking anything. People will riot over a fucking soccer game. You're telling me people didn't do something like this?
I didn't know until a few days ago that there was a huge court case for a government conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King.
Oh, yeah.
It was found guilty, the whole thing. Everybody implicated within the government. But there was absolutely no media coverage. You can look at the whole court transcript. If anybody listening doesn't believe me, it's a proven conspiracy as much as something can be proved within the court of law.
Oh, there's a great book written on it. Yeah, there's a whole
I mean, I never fucking heard that. Someone told me that recently. My friend told me that, and then I was like, I went to look it up, and I guess it's people.
Well, as you say, you never heard about it. So you're right. Why isn't, every January, there's going to be CNN and NBC will be like, remembering Dr. Martin Luther King's leg, some shit like that, you know, like. Mm-hmm. We hear at NBC, the largest manufacturer of arms in the world, want to take today to wish you all a very happy Martin Luther King Day. You know, but no one says,
day's your day.
Right. By the way, while we're talking about his legacy, let's talk about the fact that, guess what? These people fucking did it. Let's talk about that. No, it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Right. Let's talk about that, and then let's listen to the drum major instinct.
Every year, right?
Yeah.
Well, I interviewed this guy. I interviewed a man by the name of Abraham Bolden. I don't know if you all have ever heard of him, but he was the first black Secret Service agent, and he was assigned to Kennedy. Mm. And he was a whistleblower, and he blew the whistle on how the Secret Service was just really lax as hell. And he was like really upset about it and wanted to get something done about it. And they ended up framing him for bribery or something like that. Didn't happen. Had no proof. He was black. He got convicted. And that's how they got rid of him. That's how they got rid of whistleblowers back then. But he's got a book out and everything. He knew it was going to happen. He knew it was going to happen. He warned people, and he was a Secret Service agent. So. The real whistleblowers, nobody knows their names.
Right.
Nobody knows their names. They live in obscurity.
They get punished so hard. Yeah. The most recent one I really liked, I think it was Russ something. I'm pretty sure I'm forgetting. Anyway, he was big in the recent wiretapping thing, and he revealed on like Russia Today that even Obama's been tapped, and that he was heard them talking about Obama being tapped when he was like a senator. And just like fascinating to think about like the bribery and and if anyone's read like John Perkins, any of John Perkins's book, he's quite open about how blackmail is used to manipulate people. And that shadier side of it also interests me, just as a random tangent that came to mind for some reason.
So it always makes me wonder about whistleblowers that get, you know, whistleblowers in parentheses, you know, that get a lot of attention, because why are they getting attention?
Right.
I always have to ask myself that, knowing what real whistleblowers go through. And then, you know, some get some red carpet thrown out there and you hear about them on NBC for months on end.
So. I'm so with
that
you.
Out there.
I'm so with you, but don't you think? All right, okay. So, I wrestle with this because it's clear that yes, your average whistleblower gets thrown under a bus, and randomly certain whistleblowers get turned into celebrities, and now our sort of gut reaction is to say this person is clearly an agent or a controlled opposition. But then we also have to, I also have to wonder, what does that say about a well-intentioned person, right? Let's say you're a whistleblower and you're like, okay, if only I can make it to the world and tell them my story and everyone will fucking listen, you know, hope we can get this out. All you can ever hope for is to succeed, and the moment you do is the moment that you've lost any credibility.
Right.
Like, that's the mind fuck.
Well, yeah, it is, but, you know, I think actually there's lots of examples of, you know, the real thing out there. And they do achieve a certain level of respect and success, but always stay sort of a little bit, you know, alternative. Never really make it to NBC, or might make it to MSNBC once or twice, you know? So, yeah, I mean, that is interesting, isn't it? But I think still at this point in time, it's pretty easy to tell the difference between an Edward Snowden and a Sybil Edmonds, you know? I mean,
sure.
Or a Randy Quaid.
It's easy. Right, like, that was odd.
Here, I am so with you. So, like I said, I'm so with you that it's clear that there certain people are, you know, essentially actors, or they might even be genuine and just be, again, it's like a controlled opposition, a useful idiot, whatever it might be, or there's just a way to spin the story. I'm so with you. I just sort of, at the same time, I try and put myself in the shoes of, as you say, a Sybil Edmonds. Let's say she, you know, okay, Katie Couric says, holy shit, I never heard of that. Let's put her, let's put this lady on primetime fucking television. Wouldn't that be the moment you'd go, I don't know if I can trust Sybil Edmonds anymore? Do you get what I'm saying? It's sort of like there's a trap built into this.
I think at this point, I do get what you're saying, but I still think at this point, if Katie Couric decided she wanted to do it, she would be told no.
Right.
Yeah, she has no power. No.
Oh, listen, I mean, fuck Katie Couric. Fuck her hard in the ass.
Yeah.
I'm just using her as an example, but no, like, right, let's be very clear, you know. I'm not in any way...
Same with Savannah Guthrie.
Same with what?
She would be told the same. Savannah Guthrie or whatever. I mean, they would all be told no.
Right.
Anybody took a shine.
But like I said, I just sort of I guess I'm trying to make two different points. Is yes, absolutely, abso-fucking-lutely, your point is 100% valid. And as a sort of separate, what the fuck do we do about that? Is we also, like, we're, we sort of have, it goes back to a stereotype that the only reason I point this out is because I feel like there's a sort of reverse psychology that can be used against us. You know, it's like, you know, talking to someone like, oh, if someone, you know, what, if you were to picture a quote unquote enlightened person, you know, are you picturing like a poor monk? You know, because, oh, if they had any kind of status, and not that I think, you know, the Deepak Chopra or the Dalai Lama are enlightened people, you know, they're that bullshit celebrity, whatever, right? I'm just saying we have a sort of, it goes back to a stereotypical concept that we have an image in our mind of who's trustworthy and who's not. And the reason I'm sort of stressing this is only to say that we within this sort of, you know, tentacles of alternative research, there's a trap laid out there for us. And that's all I'm really trying to say is that if someone actually were to make it to, whether it be, you know, like, I think Alex Jones, I have no love of Alex Jones. But when you see people go, oh, look how much money he's making. Clearly he's a shill. David Icke, clearly he's a shill because he's making all this money. Now, I actually think they're both, you know, like Alex Jones, I don't trust him. David Icke, I'm not really behind his whole, you know, that's somebody who I think crosses that line between I'm actually anti-Zionist, oh wait, I'm actually anti-Jew. You know, there's some sticky territory with all these people. I don't follow them, I'm not into them, but I just see how people will go, oh, I fucking love Alex Jones. I fucking love Alex Jones. Then one day they're like, holy shit, that dude's making $2 million. Clearly he's a shill. And maybe that is, maybe this is a good litmus test. Is he turning around that money into building a truth-telling machine? Or is he on a yacht with prostitutes? You know, maybe this is a good litmus test. All I'm really trying to say is we have these triggers built into our trust mechanism. And again, maybe Alex Jones on a yacht, you go, you know, maybe this guy isn't as sincere as he once was. I'm totally cool with that being the threshold for that. But if a whistleblower, if somebody had information, you know, okay, take your fucking conspiracy, whatever it is, you know, let's say it's white genocide, because this is an easy one to just, you know, okay. Let's say fucking Oprah Winfrey, Bill Gates, and David Rockefeller, and Albert Pike's zombie corpse are meeting in secret to eradicate the white race, okay? And they meet up at midnight every night and talk about destroying the white race. And somebody gets a fucking batshit on videotape, right? And we got the fucking linchpin evidence here. The minute that shit went on TV would be the minute all of us would go, that guy's fucking scamming me. And that's all I'm really trying to say is there's a trap that I just want to make us all aware of. And just to think about that there's a – because this reverse psychology can be used against us, that we're saying this person is only trustworthy if they're marginalized. The minute anyone takes them seriously is the minute we no longer trust them. And this is – because then all they need to do to discredit somebody is give them 5 minutes of fucking airtime. Mm-hmm. And we all go, oh, well, don't listen to that guy anymore. And really, it costs them nothing. Here, go ahead. Give this guy 5 fucking minutes. Who gives a shit?
Yeah. I was reading a letter. Yeah, somebody had written a letter to. Country. Oh, I'm sorry. Before it's news.
I'm just saying it.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Sorry.
Go ahead. No, I was just saying that's a big problem in Indian country is that right there, is that reverse psychology of, well, if anybody's, you know, doing good, you know, they're doing something wrong, unless they're, you know, opening a soup kitchen or something. You know, it's that you know, success equals selling out, that whole idea of selling out. That's a big punk rock thing too, you know, but it's a big thing in the Indian country too.
Yeah.
There's this, you know, self sabotaging too that goes on.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I see it every, especially within this alternative movement, I see it all the fucking time. And it's kind of insane. And as you know, you use the soup kitchen example. I mean, it's a perfect example. I knew a woman who opened a restaurant that she would do, hey, okay, you know, everyone, if you came to the counter and said you couldn't afford to pay, there were like two items on the menu that you could get for like free or for a dollar. And other people could come and you have the option, you could pay a little extra to help support that system. And then she would also do like food vouchers, or somebody could come and like sweep up the restaurant at the end of the night and you get a free meal, you know, like just like little tasks. And, you know, she was just a person. But I would speak to people who worked there who were like, oh yeah, but you know, she's actually making like good fucking money. She's a hypocrite. And I'm like, I don't know if that really makes her a hypocrite. She has a business that's successful. And she's trying to give back to the community. I don't really see, like, to me, she's not Mr. Burns. She's not like, I don't know why people are like, oh, how dare she that she's being successful. It's like, she's successful and she's sharing. That's pretty fucking nice.
Right. My housemate was just telling me about Steve McQueen back in the day. I guess he used to have all these demands whenever he would do a film for all this extra shit. And he would get all of these pants. He was like, oh, you know, I'll do this if I get this many pants for every, you know. This is like all this, you know. Other people were just like, well, okay, well, you know, whatever Steve McQueen asked for, you know, we'll give him. And he was raised in an orphanage situation, a boys' home situation. And it turned out that he was taking all of this stuff, like large amounts of stuff, and then bringing it to the specific place in which he grew up. And he would just drop all this clothes on the video and all these different things. You know, he's just donating all the stuff that were in his demands for a film. Meanwhile, he's doing blow and he's got hookers and doing that whole trip. But simultaneously, he had that, you know, but that wasn't for the public. It wasn't for display. That was something that came out eventually. He did it because he cared, you know. But I don't know. I think people are so dynamic. There's no good and bad people generally. There's some pretty rotten apples in the bunch for sure. But there's also, you know, people are able to rationalize what they're doing in all kinds of ways too. That sometimes, you know, it's like they're just really able to lie to themselves really, really, really well, you know, or whatever, I guess, you know. I mean, it goes all over the place. We're dynamic beings, I guess, is my point.
And I was just contemplating good versus evil, or talking about it the other day, and trying to get a better handle on what I think of that, really. And I guess in a Newtonian sense, it seems like obvious. On a classical, everyday level, it seems like you can make clear demarcations, or in other cases, I don't think you can. Like, even someone as bad as, like, the Unabomber who's killed all these people, like, read what he has to say, and you can see some truth in what he's saying. It, like, I'm not saying go perform terrorism or do anything. My God, no. It's like, you can't dismantle the master's house with the master's tools kind of thing. It's not the answer, and it's not. It's just his conclusions are all wrong in that sense of how to make change in the world, but you can see yourself in anybody when you really look at it, and to really like be too judgmental or whatever. I think there's like right and wrong or some element to that. I think there's some small t truth that's closer to reality than others, but that's part of it, is recognizing that, okay, yeah, people are complex and I'm complex, and I can see myself in this complex person, even though it's like, wow, I can learn from their mistakes or whatever I perceive their mistakes to be. And so I don't know. I don't know if there's ever like transcending that dichotomy or what it really stands for. And is evil like an inherent thing, or is it something that's like created from a split and not being able to center yourself afterwards?
Yeah. Well, it's a topic of one of Baruch's, you know, upcoming videos. Is just the subject of evil. And I was like, oh, boy, you know, and I know people have such a charge, especially when it comes to religion, on that word even being said. I mean, it's just because of the way that gets, you know, put in people's faces, you know.
Yeah, well, I was just talking to a magician, and he said, like, he categorizes them by, like, aggressiveness, not so much good or evil, which I thought was an interesting way of viewing it. I don't know if that's the total way of viewing it, but that's one perspective on it, maybe.
Right. Well, the description's not the described, and that's something to keep in mind whenever you're dealing with, like, public relations on any level. I mean, what can... in contemporary times we referred to as public relations has gone back pretty fucking far. I mean, before that it was before that, whatever. But the general mindset, when someone says a word, I mean, we're over here talking about conspiracy theories, conspiratorial ideas. When someone says conspiracy, why is there this immediate, on a consensus kind of general level, it's imbued with a certain energetic. Did that come from us? Where the fuck did that, like, know. You know, like...
It makes it it's, again, it's like a word that's so hard to use. It's like, Kira Smith, you know, the anti-Zionism, anti-Jew, you know, conflagration there. It's, to me, it's the same thing. Every time I want to say conspiracy, I hesitate. I'm like, conspiracy, like,
because, yeah, but like, it's the same reason.
I know
why
it's a loaded fucking word, right?
Yeah, if you think breakfast, you're thinking eggs and bacon and toast or whatever it is that you're thinking. Where did that come from? Like, you know, this is like, it's amazing the degree to which a small group can affect a multitude who just are like sponges. And when an opinion, like we there's, it's amazing how that operates. Television has made it a lot easier than it used to be, I think, in a certain way. While simultaneously we have access to so much information, we're still kind of like conditioned and programmed to this high degree. It's just there's so many examples of it, and there's examples that people wouldn't even think that they're being influenced all over the place, you know, for various reasons. You know,
and it
you
wasn't
want to direct the
like
mindset.
That.
Not to this degree. There's always been people trying to influence like multitudes, yeah. But not in this kind like no. This way. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like it used to be okay for people, you know, to talk about conspiracies. You weren't thought of as a nut. It was like, you know, like you were talking about your childhood. People talked about the JFK conspiracy, and it wasn't a,
no,
you know, you're automatically from a paranoid personality disorder, though.
No,
you know,
people,
I mean,
just kind of like stepped aside and were like, I think that there may be something fucked up about, you know, like, I don't want to say it, but
yeah.
No, and, you know, people like, you know, if you go on to Google, I think I said this before on the show, but I find it really interesting that if you just type in like alchemical formula or whatever, and you're looking at imagery that's very old, from maybe the 15th century, or, you know, the back to the 12th century, 13th century, you know, you look at this stuff and it just pops right up, right? It's at your fingertips. People used to be killed for owning such a thing if they were found out. I mean, Eliphas Levy was, you know, killed by the church, and his last words were something along the lines of, oh my God, if I knew it was going to end like this, I wouldn't have been so secretive. I wouldn't have been so, you know, I wouldn't have held back so much. The church has gone after, you know, but they themselves have the conspiracy. See, that's the another irony, right? It's like people talk about 9/11 conspiracy theories. Meanwhile, we're being fed a conspiracy theory that we're reacting to. And so the conspiracy theorists are the ones who are objecting to a conspiracy theory that's being shoved down their throats of the hijackers and the whole, this particular way, the fucking passport that somehow gets recovered, but the black box doesn't. You know what I mean? It's like, what is the more wackadoo conspiracy theory? Because obviously people coming together to, you know, to manipulate other people, or to, you know, I mean, they conspired. I mean, we're being fed a conspiracy theory. I mean, I feel like this is the most obvious thing in the world, yet somehow the connotation is being opposed to the official story became the thing that got the negative view. You know, it's just, I mean, it makes sense why that would happen, but I'm just amazed at people's gullibility and, you know, degree of being allowed to be influenced. That it's nuts.
But so where do we draw the line? And, you know, this is something that sort of blows my mind, is, again, it's like the weird sort of the psychological manipulation goes so far. It's kind of like, you know, the boy who cried wolf type thing, that there are things that we now doubt everything, which is, you know, in one way is super healthy, but also to the point of, you know, 9/11 happens and it's like, there were people, there's a few people who, like, went to New York to verify, like, they weren't even sure if they should believe that, like, there were buildings there. You know, it's like, how, is this a Truman Show scenario, right? Like, is there even a World Trade Center? How do I know if this, if I've been lied to my whole fucking life about this sort of thing, you know, like people went this far, and like I sometimes talk to people and like, oh, the whole thing was faked and blah blah blah, and nobody died, and it's like, well, okay, can we pull back on that? Because I know people actually died. I know people who were in the building. You know, it's like, and even, and some of them, like there's a girl who I knew for many, many years leading up to this. She was my best friend's girlfriend, and she goes to work that morning, and she gets out of the subway station just minutes after. So she comes up out of the subway station and sees like a cop car on fire in the middle of the street, and she's like, "What the fuck is this?" You know, and she's like, you know, on her way to work there, and she's like, everything's fucking crazy, and so it's like after the planes have hit, but not the buildings haven't fallen, all this sort of shit. And I spoke to her within hours of that, and we spent the next few days together, and okay, so this is ingrained in her mind. Her and this guy end up breaking up. I bump into this girl like a year fucking later on the street. Okay? Again, we were, you know, this is my friend's girlfriend from many years. We were friendly or whatever, we're just talking. And we're just chatting a little bit and blah blah blah, and then out of like nowhere, she looks to me and she goes, "You know, so I've been kind of thinking about this whole 9/11 thing, and I'm not sure that I believe what was told to me." You know, and like, wow, like I just, one of the last people on Earth I would have thought. So like, wow, so glad to hear it. And I also, you know, like no one would listen to me and no one listened to her. And okay, so this is people where the facade is starting to crack. That's wonderful. And then, but then, like, there's, you know, you talk to somebody else, and they'll be like, "Oh, I'm not even sure that that happened." Like, well, no, it happened. It might not have happened the way you were told, but you know what I'm saying? It's like we sort of the psychology is to push the conspiracy further and further and further, that you muddy the waters to such a degree. You know, is it fucking? Is it not enough to have a global CEO that's turning the population into slaves, or do they have to be like reptilian overlords? You know, like it's not enough.
Right.
It's not enough that, and to me, ultimately, I don't care if they're fucking if it's a goddamn zebra in a top hat, whatever the fuck it is.
I think it is a zebra in a top hat, actually.
Right, yeah, one. I thought you might appreciate that.
You can't put them on trial for being a reptilian overlord, you know? And how are you going to bring that up in
Right. Yeah. So what's the trigger? What's the difference between someone who says, "That reptilian overlord's thing's bullshit," and someone who's like, "Yeah, I'm convinced. I watched enough David Icke, you know, bullshit videos to buy that crap." You know, what's the difference, you know, between the
for me
and you know, why are those traps out there? Is there, you know,
right? And
because
that's
of numbers,
like there's a way to avoid the trap. At least for me, is to keep it simple. When in the sense of like you said, hey. Is race bullshit? You know, or is there? Did you have a finer point? Like, no, basically, race is bullshit. Like, my thing is, the moon landing hoax. I don't really get worked up over the moon landing hoax because guess what? One of two things happened. Either we faked the whole thing and our government is lying to us, as it usually fucking does, or they made it. And let's take that "hey, we made it" scenario.
Well,
to simplify, to make a quick point, and we're not trying to, is to say, since the dawn of man, we've looked up at the moon and said, one day, what is this? It's this mysterious and amazing object that we've always dreamed of, right? And we fucking, let's say, we actually make it. What do? We take the gaudiest fucking flag that's ever been created on Earth, plant it in the fucking ground, put a plaque there with Richard Nixon's name on it, and go, "Ours. This is ours now. Fucking did this." Right?
But don't forget the Masonic ceremony on top
sure,
of it.
Sure, right. But my point is, like, you know what? Neither of those scenarios really, you know, inspire me.
Right.
So I could sit here and worry about a conspiracy that says, did we fucking fake it, or are we really that big of a fucking douchebag nation that we just claimed the fucking moon? That we just planted a fucking flag and claimed the moon? Which of those two scenarios they're both offensive to me. So the thing is, I can get worked up over, is it a reptilian or is it a Rockefeller? Is it a this or a that? Or I can say, wait, this whole system is fucked. Let me work against the obvious end result and the mechanisms and all these things and try and dismantle that. So this way, if we were to dismantle those mechanisms, it doesn't matter if it's a reptilian or a zebra or a David Rockefeller or Oprah Winfrey. It doesn't matter who the fuck tries to take control of the pyramid because we've dismantled the fucking mechanism. To me, right, that's the only answer that makes sense rather than worrying about all the these little fine details.
Right. I mean, specifically to that, you know, I mean, I was about to jump in and be like, hey, because, you know, I don't agree with a lot of Jay Widener. You know, I don't know about some of the things that he has to say, at least in terms of his authority on the matter. But I think it is a very, very reasonable consideration that, and I think that this happens a lot, where something happens, something goes down, it's very real, but there is a another version of it that's presented in a very cinematic way for the populace. And I consider that there's a I'm open very much to the possibility that even if there is nothing found on the moon that was of any significance, that they were hoping that there would be, and that whatever we're watching as a, you know, on our televisions all glued sitting up close like, oh my God, they landed on the moon, was quite possibly filmed ahead of time. And just, you know,
sure,
I don't, I,
I'm totally, it actually makes a ton of fucking sense. No one knew what the fuck we'd find there. Indiana Jones opening the Ark of the Covenant, let's pretend that actually happened today. You probably don't want to like live stream that on CNN just in case
everyone's faces will melt
off. Right? I'm glad you got that.
Yep. Totally.
Oh, jeez. So, excuse me. All right, Kira, so I guess my question is, you do two shows now, right? So your main show, which is The Bridge, and then you're doing a new one with your friend, is that correct? So it's like more of a, is it a show for women or just a show by women?
Yeah, well, it's called The Moon Lodge, and the idea behind it is that it's sort of a vision that both of us had a long time ago. Nobody got it, and then we met each other and finally found out there was another person out there that got it. And that is that, you know, at one time, all women in the tribe would bleed together and we would go to the lodge and that would be our time to seek our vision. And we would use that for for our communities. And so what we're trying to do basically is create a postmodern menstrual lodge, moon lodge, where we use that sacred energy and that sacred process for the benefit of our communities instead of it being siphoned off in the ways that it is siphoned off. And so it's for women, but it's also for men too, because it's an opportunity for men to see what women really care about instead of what's programmed about what really women really care about. And so, you know, we're winging it, because we're creating something new out of something old, but in a new sort of way. Because community, we have to create community in a different way now, because we're in a different world. And that's kind of what I guess you guys really are doing with the Sync community. You're creating community in a different way. We're finding people who think weird like us, you know. We're finding the other weirdos to create a community with. That in a way that benefits everyone, including ourselves. I mean, obviously, but yeah. So that's really the idea behind the Moon Lodge, and we have it every new moon. And it's just the way we're using the energy of that sacred time to, create something beneficial, you know, because it's been siphoned, that energy has been siphoned from ourselves and from our communities for so long that it can only be a good to bring it back.
Yeah, and I see something like a little symbolically significant about like Always Record or any show that goes 3, 4, 5 people, larger conversations, which is, yeah, it's a way different dynamic. It's more of a multi, once you hit 3, you're in like multi-body physics and it becomes highly complex and nonlinear. And, but also, you know, there's less hierarchy associated with it. It's more a circuit that has a continuum to it, but isn't meant to, no one's there to impose their will necessarily. So it's like learning the art of how to dialogue in that way.
Podcast anarchy.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Podcast anarchy. Yay.
Yeah. Well, and it's like,
I do the show with,
mm-hmm.
Sorry, my friend that I do the Moon Lodge with, Carrie Lee, she also has a site called Recipe for Anarchy. And, you know, so that's, we talk about, you know, self-rule. That's one of our, you know, topics that we cover.
Well, I know we're, I don't know how much time you have left. I know it's getting a little late on your end, but would you be willing to go there a little bit and sort of, what, you know, is this something, you know, again, within the sort of these different fields, people come away with different philosophies. Do you have an essentially anarchist philosophy? I'm totally supportive of it. If so, I'm just sort of have you come away with a sort of system for self-governing and in your own life?
Yes and no. I mean, we're winging it, right? So if anarchist philosophy, I'm down with it. You know, I'm completely down with it, but it's still a philosophy, you know? So, you know, putting that into real life, that's the real challenge, right? Because we still exist in, you know, in the world that we exist in, that thinks of anarchy as chaos, right? So, So for myself, my philosophy about how to manifest, you know, this, my own anarchist philosophy into my life would be to unplug as much as possible from the control grid, would be one word for it, you know, from the system. But, you know, it's kind of ironic because I do work for the government, you know, so, but,
I do,
you
too.
Know, I have limited choices. Yeah.
I love
but I help people. I mean, I work for the. I work for the only agency that's really there to help people their very worst possible time. I do disaster really well. I do calm really well. I do compassion. You know, I'm doing compassion work with my government. My job. So we still have these systems that we have to work with, but we can still manifest anarchy within those systems too, in, you know, maybe small ways, but
right.
And it's funny because
I mean, you got to be careful when you're using terms like anarchy, because people are being put on trial. I have a close friend of a friend who just was in front of a judge, asked, "Are you an anarchist?" And she felt, because of her moral obligation, that she had to say yes. But I'm just like, the description's not the described. You're saying one thing. So my friend's like, what do I do when they take me and they ask me the same question? I'm like, you fucking say no, unless if your definition of anarchy meets this and this and this criteria. Because now it just, anarchist means terrorist. They've made it a point to link the two.
Right.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. It's just, that's like a major thing that's come up a lot, you know.
And it's a dangerous thing. So I guess I get around it by saying I'm down with anarchist philosophy, but does that make me an anarchist? I don't know.
Right.
I'm just philosophizing.
Sure, and I guess that's why I was trying to open it up. I think these are, you're both making excellent points. I guess I wanted to try and open up exactly is what what have you been able to kind of incorporate into your life so far? Because I think just saying, yeah, I'm an anarchist, doesn't really say much. Because that's just, all that means is whatever connotations you have, sure, you can think of me like that. So basically, what in your own life have you been able to incorporate? And it doesn't just have to be from an anarchist philosophy. You were talking about the Moon Lodge. I mean, what have you been able to, in all this stuff, from Thomas Sheridan, I know you work close with him and this, you know, dealing with a psychopathic nature, to dealing with feminine nature, working with Indians. So what have you been able to actually take out of the realm of philosophy and talk radio and into physical life?
Well, I mean, I do live in the woods. I live alongside a lot of other life forms besides humans, which is one way to bring, I think, people back to reality, because we tend to forget that we share this planet with other life forms. And I just like living in the woods. I like growing my own food. I think that's huge, growing your own food. To be able to do that has become a privilege in our world, and it should be what we do.
Right.
We should know where our food comes from, you know? And I've gotten into like foraging and just anything that I could do to unplug. Music, you know, I sing at powwows and stuff, anything that connects us. And my spiritual practice is compassion and gratitude. So I start every day with a gratitude prayer, and it's a long one, and the longer the better, you know? Yeah. And yet we have to be thankful for our lives, for our relationships, you know, for all the gifts. We have to orient ourselves towards the gifts we're given every day. Yeah. Because it's the privilege to be able to be connected, because we're so unconnected. I mean, the ironic thing is that my mother, I would consider my mother a mystic, but she's a scientist as well. And I think that she came to her mysticism through trauma. And I think I did as well, which is kind of odd. I mean, it's kind of weird. But I was thinking about that the other day, how trauma can orient you towards a reality in a way that maybe others who have never experienced it never get to. I don't really know how to put it in words, but...
No, it's true.
Disassociation. You know, I had an out-of-body experience through trauma, so which I forgot from the time I was 8 years old until I was 25. And once I remembered it, then I started learning about spirituality and, you know, how there's, in the Lakota system, there's four different aspects to our soul. There's your Naya, which is like the astral projection. You know, that piece of you that can leave or disassociate through trauma or travel while you're dreaming, or and that piece of you, when it's traveling, it collects that life force energy, that chi, or another aspect of your soul, which is sukkun, which holy people, medicine people, they have a lot of it. That's why they can share it and help to heal people, because they can push that life force energy. They can manipulate it in a way that other people haven't learned yet. And then there's that ghostly aspect of our soul. So that's the one piece of us that remembers living before, that remembers our past lives, or the piece that sticks around if you're not kind of sent off in the proper ways, or if you die through trauma, or if you're not expecting to die, if you're not ready to die, that kind of thing. And then there's that piece of God that we all carry with us. And so when I first learned about this, it made so much sense to me, because when I remembered the trauma that happened to me, all this spiritual knowledge just boom. It was like a piece of me came back, literally. And I woke up in the morning with a huge silver patch of hair coming out of my crown chakra. I was 25, and I was on a drug that turned off my pituitary gland and put me in temporary early menopause because I had a big fibroid, a big huge tumor that made me look pregnant, and it was too big to surgically remove, so they had to shrink it by turning off my pituitary gland because estrogen feeds the growth of it, the tumor. And so I went into this menopausal state early. That's when I remembered this trauma. And it was like a accidental initiation. You know, it was when I became a poet and had all this. And so, yeah, and all the spiritual knowledge just boom, I just knew stuff. And I had no idea how I knew stuff. And then later, you know, came into contact with people who had a reason to know these things and confirmed them for me. But so my Naya was traveling that whole time, from the time I was 8 until I was 25. Just gathering spiritual knowledge and chi, life force energy, and then boom, came back, boom, like that. So I don't know, I got off on a tangent there, but
no, you
told
didn't.
A story.
That's not a tangent, that's awesome, that. Thank you. Yeah, wow. Yeah, I mean, all so essential I knowledge is innate, right? Dude, it's kind of a joke in a way. It's like, I relate it to like cell growth, how cells need to divide in order to expand and how they're two sides of the same thing. And whenever you get a new piece of knowledge, you're interpreting the information. And when you agree that, yes, I understand, it's actually already understood. It's just, there's been more concepts constructed around the thing that's there to begin with. And so it's kind of an illusion in a way, right? The idea of accumulation of knowledge doesn't accumulate, because knowledge is always here already in the truest sense. The knowledge that's accumulated is not truly knowledge. It's actually more of like a aversion to to the thing, because it's beating around it in a sense, you know.
True, very true. So am I answering these questions? I mean, I don't know.
Oh,
I seem to
heck yeah.
And I go on.
welcome to Always Record. Right.
Yeah.
We think we're answering a question, and we kind of go off on tangents and explore. And I mean, to me, this is so. What you described is that, you know, sort of Gnostic immediate knowing, a realization, an actual connection to the truth and to spirituality and to the Godhead and all these sorts of things. And all we can ever do is try our damnedest to bring it down into language. And since that connection to the divine is literally everything, there's no topic or tangent to a question that isn't applicable in my mind, because it's in order to encapsulate everything, you kind of have to get there. How do you get there?
Any way you can.
So. You go everywhere. That's the whole point. Aimless wandering. There's like one of my favorite principles from self-organization theory is you mostly see it in hive mind situations. So it's not exactly a flattering analogy. And I don't, you know, I'm not drawing a one-to-one correspondence, but in like ant communities, or I mean, the members of the community will just fucking wander out, wander aimlessly, kind of like looking for food or whatever they need to survive. And it's like highly non-systemic or highly non-systematic. There's like, yes, there's a hive mind they're existing within, but there actually is all this individualism, and that the ants learn from each other as they keep wandering out further and further, and they like find each other's bodies and shit. So the lesson is learned as they move forward. But I guess like the human story has similar trajectories if you just think of it in like, I don't know, that larger cosmic sense. If you really want to zoom out far, I mean, we're very small, so small that it's really crazy to think about. So in that sense, like, yeah, that's how you arrive at genuine knowledge or self-knowledge or whatever, some synthesis of the two. Like, knowing is a form of remembering or something. It's like, yeah, you're just bringing it out from what was always there. And then that's the question of, where did knowledge even come from? Is it just like totally evolutionary, or is it something embedded in space itself? So those are fun questions too, I guess.
But yeah, isn't that even
a lot to go into?
Sorry, isn't that even how you described, you said a piece of your soul was out wandering for all these years just collecting knowledge? I mean, that's...
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, that's what we're doing.
Very, very, very... Mm-hmm.
It's just nice that now we're hopefully we're at a point where enough of us can kind of say, you know, we're out here wandering and see each other out on the road and say, hey, you want to walk together for a little
bit? Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's all we're really doing.
Yeah, because otherwise it's like...
Absolutely.
Well, it's fucking hard to find each other in the street. It's like, I wouldn't know. I'm like, was spending some time in New York City, and I was just walking around. It's like, there's so many people. It's so, I don't know. I'm judging. I don't know. I'm projecting all these thoughts onto these people. And it's like, you'd never know how to spot one of your own unless you can see auras and shit, which I cannot do yet. Maybe someday. And I'm not pinning my hopes on that. So using the internet and like having these kinds of gathering places and points of attraction for people are important. And just, yeah, in terms of just having like a more fruitful life, I guess, at the very base of it. If you want to cut away all other philosophical shit about it, it's like, hey, it's a enrich your life, then whatever, it's good.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's to be balanced, though, that's for sure.
Of course. Because you don't want to desacralize the material either and like get your head too much in the clouds, and vice versa. It's the middle ground that's the hardest to walk, but it's always where the truth lies. There's all kinds of different truths within that, but I think there's
where the truth lies.
Yeah, right. It's like there's enough truth to go around, and everyone can kind of shape it themselves in a bit, but it's in that in-between space that if you're too fractionalized or too compartmentalized or too extremist, you'll never find it.
Here, it sounded as if, though, when you said it needs to be balanced, it seemed like a sort of pointed statement in the sense of that there was something specific. Would you like to sort of expand on that? Or maybe it was just my interpretation?
Well, yeah. I mean, for myself, I struggle with the balance because I've discovered this new thing that you can share your writing with people and they might actually, like it, So from through blogging, and so wow, you can share it and people will read it, because when I first started writing, I tried to get it published and people were like, fuck you, so I was like, well, I guess I'm not a writer then, but now I write and people respond and it's this great thing. So I struggle with how long do I keep it to myself and develop it more before I share it? Because I kind of gave up on it for a little bit, not with the poems, but with the other type of writing that I do. So I'm just, I struggle with it. I don't know what the answer is yet. And then also with social media, it's like, I struggle with that too. What's the balance there? How much is this taking me away from living, but I'm really getting something out of being able to share my work for the first time in my life. So it's a struggle.
Yeah. I hear that.
I don't know if this is really applicable, but this has been the end, because I totally sympathize with that. And all I can really do in this case is say this is the answer I've kind of come to on that, is that there's a time and a place. So some so if there's a piece of writing that feels like this is a really big statement, this is a really something, then that might mean you sit on it and develop it. You know, I have something that I've been writing, and it's like the thing that I really care about. It's going to take me years to get that to a point where I really want to share it. But there's other things that, you know, through a social media or something where these are faster statements. So it's like almost like having different outlets. So like when you say, here you have The Bridge, is your show to interview and explore specific topics, but then you might go to the Moon Lodge to delve into something else and to just change, by changing the environment, you literally change the focus and, you know, a sort of medium is the message type thing. So in that same sort of way, I've created for myself, okay, always recorders where we can really stretch out and dive into all these sort of topics, and it doesn't have to be formalized, and it can be both fun, but it can also go really deep just by giving ourselves the time to do so. But I've done different formats where, okay, this is what I'm going to do, and it's going to be a 20-minute interview, or this is an essay, or this is news, this is whatever, and by giving myself different sort of fractured outlets, it's not as much fracturing my personality, but giving each of those different things. So I'm not at the point where I want like a Twitter 140 character outlet that's meaningless to me. But okay, there's a time and a place for putting something out on social media that's just basically, hey, this is the point, this is really all I want to say about this, or this is a conversation I want to start about something, or, you know, whatever. Or just be part of a conversation. And that doesn't mean you being a conversation is also being a listener. So it doesn't mean if I'm on social media, I'm mostly reading other people's comments and just maybe writing a few sentences, because I have plenty of outlets for me to speak. I don't really feel the need to do that on social media. So it's anyway, so I guess I'm saying, like, that's at least the answer I've come to. I don't know if that's helpful at all or applicable to your life, but that's, so I'm just sharing that as something that's kind of helped me, is to have different outlets.
That's worked for you. Yeah, that's good. I mean, and I guess that's sort of in a way where I've been going, where things have been evolving to or something, you know, is these different outlets are just sort of popping up. I mean, that's the way The Bridge popped up, and the way the Moon Lodge popped up is they just popped up. You know, in my own blog, that's something I did in an effort to heal, but it's really turned into, and all of this, you know, all of the what I'm doing is turned into, I realized I was getting like this intellectual stimulation that I wasn't getting before, you know, and I didn't realize I was missing it until I got it. So you know, it's sort of evolved into that, because I think I have healed a lot from the damage of being targeted by a psychopath in the workplace. You know, I'm not having my career destroyed and everything. I'm not like, I just don't care anymore. It's like, there's other things I can do.
I tend to feel a huge sense of urgency when it comes to artistic expression in general. I don't know how to explain it. I mean, I know I just had 36 videos disappear from Vimeo. I got my account terminated for copyright from, you know, 1,000 hours of work, you know. And many of the videos still exist, but it felt as though the whole time I was doing it that I'm like, this is a mandala. I'm doing it anyway. I'm going to do everything I can to get this out there, knowing that even if it doesn't last here, it's not going to last in the first place. I mean, it's like so much is like air now. I mean, there's no material. It's like, I don't know the percentage of people that are actually reading physical books anymore. It's like I don't know how you know, important this is in regards to what you're saying, but the inevitable mandala aspect of whatever it is that you're creating is both disheartening and liberating at the same time, as paradoxical as that might seem. And so, like, I found it almost like a relief when they disappeared while simultaneously feeling kind of devastated.
Just to say about the reading physical books, I'm actually going to be on Kira's show again February 24th. Happy to go onto the bridge with her. And that's one of the topics I wanted to address was physical reading, just the sort of the different mindset that comes to it. So it's just funny that you should bring that up because that was what I had proposed sort of topic to address. But so Guillaume and I have been working on this website, getting everything, like updating everything and doing a tremendous, tremendous, tremendous amount of work. And at some point he said to me something like, we were joking and I don't know if we were just getting frustrated of all the work and we joked about deleting it or something. And I was just like, please, you know, like it's going to happen one day. Let's just fucking get it over with. Blow the fucking site up, you know, whatever. Of course, joking, but there is a truth in there is he made this really profound statement. He said, think about when I was a guest on Red Ice back in 2011, I think it was when he first heard me interviewed there and he contacted me and we've become friends and worked together and like constantly working together since then, right? He said, just think about that. He said, you know, what we're creating now, someone else is going to have this experience. We're making a connection for someone we don't even know about yet. Red Ice made a connection between me and Guillaume that they don't know about. We, by doing the shows we do, we're making connections for other people that are going to go on. But he made a joke. He said, you know, since this was from Red Ice, he says, well, one day we will have become the thing we hate, you know, we'll have become supremacists in some way, or we'll have become closed-minded in some way, or at least that'll be the perception. So we're going to make a connection for somebody, and then they're going to have to move on from us. They're going to be like, you know, fuck Sync Book, those fucking dogmatic whatever the hell, right? He's saying, you know, at some point they're going to decide they don't like us, but the job has already been done. You've made a connection, and then they go on to inspire, blah, blah, blah. And some of it's joking, some of it's not. It's that really nice mix of the two. Anyway, the whole point is to say, like, you accept a certain amount of the impermanence, while at the same time, David, we need those videos. Like that, you know, they need to be shared with people. So it's like that finding that balance there is to say, knowing that at some point you have to let it go. But maybe not as literally let it go as just letting things be deleted, and I don't, you get what I'm saying.
Yeah, basically the point is that when I put those up, where I was coming from was that there is an extreme sense of urgency, and I like, am I just gonna live with, like, whenever I do a collage and I spend, you know, up to 1,200 hours working on a single thing, and I'm like, I'm compiling it and I'm building it. I'm always just, there's a huge sense of urgency in it. I have a hard time stepping away from it because I feel this obligation to, like, myself and the world to do what I'm doing for whatever crazy reason. I don't even know the reason. It's more like an impulse, you know? And I do it with full awareness that the thing won't last. And it's weird to be putting so much energy into something that you know won't last. I mean, I've had, you know, relationships where I'm aware that this isn't going to last as it is now, but I'm putting my all into it despite that. And it's an interesting phenomenon. You kind of have to, like, back up and look at the bigger picture beyond yourself and how things get built up upon the things that disappear. I mean, I found that was the most interesting thing that I heard, in my opinion, from David Crowley before he died, you know, as he was talking about that point of, like, we're whatever it is that we're doing here, that other people are doing here, in terms of whether you want to relate to it as resistance or spreading of knowledge or information, you know, it's like, this will be forgotten. Like, there's very little in the nature of the system to actually keep a record of what people's contributions actually are in terms of betterment oftentimes. I mean, I can go and I can read William Blake. That's available to me, you know? I mean, that's subversive as fucking hell, dude. It's totally subversive in the midst of his position and everything, you know? Just a completely random example. But, like, you know, there's a record of this guy's work, and you can see what he did and the materials that he used. And I get concerned sometimes about the way that media is now, that there could be no record. The whole thing could just be so easily erased, you know? And I mean, that's what the Romans did, you know, way back when with Judea. They destroyed all the historical records that they were able, and then that, you know, they emphasized one, you know, that was written by one of their own, you know, in that particular instance, it's a Jew adopted into the Flavian court, but still, like, it's like that, that phenomenon exists where the history is written by the winners, to put it as simply as possible. And I want to change that, but I, you know, I guess the art is made by the losers. So fuck it.
No, I mean, it's actually one of the reasons why I love physical books and, you know, physical media. I think, I'm not paranoid about, like, internet, takeover or something. But you have to accept that as a very real possibility, and to have something physical, tangible record, I think, is really important.
And you're not just saying that to sell more books.
a little from Kyle May. No, I mean, that was why, you know, that's one of the reasons. Like, listen, there is no money in making books. I hate to say that.
Yeah.
I hate to admit that. It's fucking true. There's no. It's way more work than you will ever receive financially, unless you're fucking Harry Potter or something, right? But even
Harry Potter wrote books.
Even the people who you think are doing well with book sales,
it's an autobiography,
right? Even the people you think are doing pretty well with books, I guarantee you are not doing what you think they're doing. Like I said, unless you're the Stephen King or a Harry Potter writer or whatever. Anyway, there's no money in it.
Music too.
What's that?
Music too.
Yeah, exactly right. But to have something physical, I mean, it's you know, like I just, so I've moved a bunch in the last year or two, and like, I just found, like, a box of old CDs that I've been enjoying. And these were things that I had, some of them I had digital copies of, but they got erased at some point or lost through a computer failure or whatever. And now I'm just, like, enjoying, like, these old songs. I'm like, oh, I miss these songs, you know? It's only because I had that physical item. Anyway. It goes back to Kira's point of, how do you maintain a cultural or linguistic legacy? Kira, for you, you're able to carry this through music, right? To a certain extent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, I have been taught some old songs, and you know, when we sing them at the powwow, at first, if they haven't heard us before, they take one look at me sitting down at the drum, like some of the older folks, and you get some sort of frowns and like, what the fuck? Who does she think she is? Uh-huh. And then we sing these really old songs, and then they come up and say, man, I haven't heard that since I was a little kid. And then they like you because you just sang their song from their childhood. Totally. So, you know, I could be the whitest of the white, and it doesn't matter anymore because we've made that connection through the song. Which is a sacred being. So, yeah.
That's what I was trying to communicate about, distinctions in culture and appreciation for distinctions, or even in interest. It's not as necessary that you have pre-knowledge of someone's culture. It's just that you're not, that if you're genuinely interested in how their culture is distinct from yours, you that brings people together way more, in my experience, than just repeating or emphasizing how similar you are. And that's an example of that. You recognize, I mean, in this case, you've learned something and you're presenting it, but at the same time, for you to learn it in the first place required your interest, which I'm sure whoever taught those to you, right. It was well received, you know, and they felt connected through your interest, you know? Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, and it's the difference between, you know, the ignorant mixed blood who, you know, says, you know, I'm part Cherokee or whatever, that every, you know, all the full bloods are making fun of. And the one who says, yeah, you know, I'm Choctaw on my mom's side. And, you know, I've taken the time to learn some of the language and songs and things, you know, there's, yeah, certainly a difference between.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Whether that makes me Indian or not, I really don't freaking care. It's just, you know.
Yeah.
It makes you you and you're awesome.
Right. There you go. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it should be okay to be, you know, some people, like my intro song, it's not sung exactly perfect. It sounds like a mixed blood singing an Indian song, but that's okay because that's what I am. So it's okay. You know, and you should take the songs and make them your own too. Because that's what they're for. That's how they live inside you. That's how they're passed on with authenticity as well. Not that you've done it exactly like, because music evolves too as we evolve. So we don't have to do it just like we were taught. We should know that version of just like we were taught, but we should be able to do it how it lives inside us too.
Well said.
Well said. Well, I know John's got another interview he has to do at the top of the hour. I know you said your kids are going to start coming home from school as well. I want to kind of wind this down, but if this has been an absolute pleasure, it's always good talking to you, but this has been a real unique pleasure to get to share with everybody at the same time. It's one of the things I really love about this format. Is there anything, where can people find your show? Give us websites, give us any information that people can find more about you, listen to past episodes of The Bridge and start diving in.
Okay. Well, my show called The Bridge with Kira is on People's Internet Radio. And that's just www.peoplesinternetradio.com. There is, if you go into the schedules on that, on the main page, you find my show, which is on Saturday nights. And if you click onto me, then you'll find my podcast storage page, which has all the latest, you know, podcasts and YouTube videos. And I also have a YouTube channel. My friend Justin does my YouTube videos. I also want to plug him too, because he did do a visual representation. He worked with Mark Korsky to do a visual representation of Engines of Domination. So you can look that up and just watch that, and you get a sense of what the book is about.
Is he the one that makes all the images for your YouTube videos? These like really beautiful sort of like poster. Mm-hmm. What's his name? Because I love them. They stand out to me. So every time you put out a show, I'm like really impressed by those visuals.
Yeah. Justin Jaswiski, he also used to work with Carrie Lee on Lifting the Veil, her show that she used to do. He does. So I have a YouTube channel, and you can just type my name, Kira Young, into the YouTube, and you'll see my channel. You'll see my, I've done a lot of shows. You'll see The Bridge, or you can type The Bridge with Kira in the search, and you come up with my channel, too. And then I have a blog called Psychopaths in Charge, which is kyoung4.wordpress.com. And that's pretty much where you can find me. I'm on Facebook, too. You can Facebook me.
Thank you so darn much.
Oh, and my husband wants me to plug the drum.
What's that?
Can I plug the drum too? It's Yellow anything? Thunder Singers.
Yeah.
My family drum.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can find my family drum on it's called Yellow Thunder Singers. on Facebook, and my husband runs that page, but you can friend us there too, and we put our gigs on there when we're singing. So
cool.
And yeah. you're in the Pennsylvania.
Think that's all.
You're in the Pennsylvania area for people who are might be able to come see a gig or something?
We're now in the northern Shenandoah Valley. We started our drums started in the Pennsylvania area. We actually met in the Bay Area at a powwow in Oakland. But we moved to central Pennsylvania to help my mom with her organic berry farm. And that's where our son was born. And so then we started our own drum when our son was born. And we moved down to the northern Shenandoah Valley so I could work for the government. But we're off in the woods. Yeah, we're real close to West Virginia as well. We could kind of walk across the creek and we'd be there. So
beautiful.
But we do powwows everywhere, all over the place. So
gotcha. Okay.
You never know where we'll.
Yeah. Well, I hope people look into where they can find you. Please listen to, not just the radio shows, but enjoy the music. You get a taste of that at the beginning of each episode of The Bridge. So I hope people really dig in and really appreciate your time and joining us today, especially making the time for
thank
us.
Thank you.
So.
Yeah, thank you so much. This has
thank
been great.
Thank you so much.
It's nice to just like wake up to this, to just jump into this conversation that was really fascinating. So yeah, awesome. We'll be right back.
thesyncbook.com, we are a community exploring the impossible. Artists and seekers looking at the interconnected nature of all things. As of 2015, Syncbook Radio has over 25 gigs of high-quality audio without a single advertisement. And we keep on growing. We now have 6 radio programs producing regular content. Clearly, we have outgrown one model and are birthing another. We have spent the last 5 years attempting to build a space where researchers and seekers can take an honest approach to this material, where people can look at these weird things without being laughed at or yelled at, to build a community that encourages each other to continue to learn and to explore. This quest began in earnest with the publication of the first Syncbook back in 2011. Since then, it has ballooned into a major undertaking, and thesyncbook.com has become a repository for cutting-edge media and all things sync. Along the way, we have found amazing allies to become an unparalleled creative team. We have met the most supportive and loving fans. And, of course, we've bumped heads with a few assholes. With all of your help, we've been able to grow and provide a platform to more artists. Now, we are asking you to take the next step with us. After investing a ton of time, energy, money, and hard fucking work, thesyncbook.com has just finished its major overhaul, and we are ready for you to make yourselves cozy here. We've installed new players for our podcasts, with streaming from fast and reliable hosting. We added expanded search functions that tap into classic sync video libraries. And our new member section gives access to our full archive of over 600 hours of podcasts, as well as members-only media, HD videos, and transcripts. There's also discounted physical copies of Syncbook Press titles, as well as Google Hangouts with the radio hosts every month. You'll also have an opportunity to tap into additional exclusive media inside Dropbox 42. For those of you unable to purchase memberships, rest assured that the 3 most recent episodes of all podcasts will remain free for everyone, every week, so regular listeners will be able to continue enjoying these shows uninterrupted. While financial realities dictate that we can't keep up this level of output and continue to give away everything for free, we've made every possible effort to make this something all of you would really want to be a part of. Please visit thesyncbook.com/membership now.